perhaps you've heard of like Irish jigging or Scottish jigging before.
Yeah.
So Métis people are inherently like a mixed people. So we're mixed raced with specifically prairie indigenous folk like Cree and Anishinaabe. And we're mixed with Scottish, Irish, and specifically French, as well as some other European identities. And so we kind of mix together the traditional dance forms of both people. So we have some Irish and Scottish dance influence in our works, but also it's grounded in this kind of powwow dance tradition. So it's kind of the best of both worlds.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And as an Indigenous woman yourself, how important has dance been for you and like you on your journey?
Yeah, I think a recent study came out that said that dance is one of the best things for treating depression.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like out of all of the exercise forms that they studied, it's been like immensely beneficial, I guess, mix of the music and the community and things. But
yeah,
I think, you know, I've struggled with mental health problems like a lot of women in the world and specifically in Indigenous communities deal with, you know, generational trauma is very real. And I think reconnecting to dance, moving my body really helps keep me sane. And especially Indigenous dance forms like jigging is such a social dance form. So it's really great for building community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you actually hold hands with people. We do like traditional square dances and round dances. So you really kind of get to be with each other. And I think it just made me a happier, better person, honestly.
Yeah, I can imagine the community building that you get from all taking part like in an activity like that. It must be so just empowering as a community.
Absolutely.
But yeah. And what does it mean for you as a woman to be performing at an event that is focusing on giving such a open space to the excluded and underrepresented voices of these communities?
Wow, yeah.
This is a bit of a loaded question.
Yeah, as a woman, gender is such an interesting thing in the dance world.
Mm.
There's this phenomena where most dancers are female, but most of the people at the very top, the choreographers, the directors, are men.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's surprising.
Yeah, so there's kind of this using of women, only the youngest, the skinniest, the whitest, the most subservient, the most obedient girls get to become prima ballerinas, and then that career will last them like 10 years tops, you know.
Yeah.
You retire at age 30, pretty much, and then you have to find another career. Whereas the men at the very top, the choreographers, I mean, don't get me wrong, I think a lot of them are really great guys, but, you know, guys like Fosse, Merce Cunningham, these guys got to continue their jobs until they died, basically. They were like 90 and still doing their jobs and still being rewarded for it, whereas a lot of people couldn't even name the prima ballerinas of major companies from the last 5 years. So there's something really empowering about being a choreographer and starting my own dance collective and getting to essentially make work for other dancers and build spaces for them to be able to perform. That's really empowering.
Yeah. I didn't ever think of it in that kind of way, that it's, again, as you see in so many areas of society, that it's the men that are still at the top. I would always, it's probably a very close-minded view that I had of dance always seemed to be more female-dominated. But when you talk about it in that way, it's the dancers, but not actually like dancers.
The industry is not built by us, no. Yeah.
And it's almost in a sense of it's a very objectifying kind of look. It's that the women are just the dancers, the objects, whereas they're being told what to do in terms of like what moves to do and stuff by men. There's a very very stalking parallel.
Yeah.
I didn't even think of.
Even down to the aesthetics of what we view as like a dancer's physique mm-hmm. was invented by men. Yeah. A lot of actually gay men at the very top. So this kind of view of like a really boyish figure was kind of imposed by men who found more boyish looking women more attractive. So that's kind of where the skinny look came from. In the very beginning, ballet was mostly more kind of plus size rounded women because that was the romantic physique. You know, if you look at old romantic paintings, that was viewed as beautiful. But because gay men kind of were able to build careers for themselves in the dance world and be respected there, they kind of imposed their aesthetic ideals onto young dancers. And it's had an incredibly lasting impact. Mm. In fact, in ballet alone, they have the highest rating of eating disorders out of any other career. Including modeling.
Oh, wow. Including modeling,
it's really bad because if you imagine it, you spend hours of your day in front of a mirror.
Yeah.
Critiquing your figure, specifically modeling your body into poses to make yourself look as aesthetically pleasing to men.
Yeah.
So this, of course, has a really huge impact on your mental health because you begin this since you're a child, right? Mm-hmm. So you kind of condition yourself time after time to look at yourself in a mirror, and it's intense.
Yeah, and I've seen so many videos of like women that are training so hard to become like professional ballet dancers and stuff, and you look at like how exhausted they look and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I couldn't even imagine. I mean, I did ballet, I think, for maybe a year when I was a kid, and then my mom took me out of it. Yeah. But for the people that is like, they live and breathe it, and then you see, you kind of see that in their bodies as well. So could you, you've touched upon it a bit, but your performance this year is based off of the science fiction novel. Is there a personal story behind it other than the connection to your name, or?
Yeah, there certainly is. So truly the main character of this cosmic trilogy is named Ransom, and he's like a wealthy white Cambridge professor from England, and it's kind of like a white savior story essentially.
Yeah.
He comes to this planet of you know, ignorant natives who don't know anything about God really, or don't understand Christianity, and he teaches it to them. And their whole planet is essentially like a Garden of Eden that has yet to have fallen. So Eve hasn't made the choice to sin yet, or to not sin. And his job is to teach her to do that. So I really related to the Eve of that planet. They call her the Queen Mother, or the Lady of Perelandra.
Mm-hmm.
I've always really connected to her because, ironically, it's quite an empowering story, although it was written by a misogynistic, racist man. You know, I actually think it's really empowering because in the end, the decision that she makes irrespective of the colonizers' words. They could have never come, and the outcome would have been exactly the same.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the most empowering story of colonialism I can imagine, is like, actually, you have had no impact on us.
Mm-hmm.
Your time on this stolen land has been meaningless. Mm-hmm. You could go home and we would be fine.
Yeah.
That is like really an empowering idea. So I really relate to her on that kind of strong woman side of things. And I also love that she's essentially the only woman on this entire planet.
Oh, okay.
There's only one man and one woman because they're Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
So she's never seen another woman. So her opinions on her femininity and her womanness is not through the eyes of the male gaze. It's not even through the eyes of the female gaze. She has no one else to compare her experience to. So she's entirely herself. And that's really something I strive to be like.
Like a world with no influence.
Yeah.
We were discussing this actually in the studio yesterday about kind of touching on this topic of whether humans are autonomous. Mm. Can you actually make your own choice and know that it is your own choice because there's so much influence around you. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of it is like you get subconsciously influenced as well, like everyone does, because mm-hmm. you're growing up in an education system that you're getting, you don't really have control when you're younger of what you're taught. So mm-hmm. your views are shaped in a specific way. Mm-hmm. And I really felt like I felt that when I came over here. So I'm from England, and in case you couldn't tell by the accent. But I
shocking.
Came, yeah. And it's a revolutionary thing. But I noticed it particularly 2 months ago when I came over and I started at the radio station. And I learned so much about England's role in colonialism over here. And we do not get taught a single thing about it in England. And I was just thinking, like, I had no idea about the indigenous trauma, the distress, everything that the indigenous communities have felt over here as a result of colonialism. Mm-hmm. And we only got taught was that just Britain colonized a lot of places. Mm-hmm. And that's all that we got taught.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that would have instantly subconsciously like shaped my view.
Mm-hmm.
And then coming over here, it's like,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, it's like blown the doors wide open.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something that I love to kind of mention that really blows people's minds is the majority of Indigenous people will never get to see their like oldest, most beautiful pieces of artwork because they were taken and brought to England and are in the archives of the British Museum.
Really?
And, you know, most Indigenous people can't afford to just go to England to go to an archive where it's not even on display most of the time. It's just in a basement, in a box. They can't afford to go do that, pay the entrance fee to go into the museum just to look at something they don't even get to take home with them.
And that's something that is rightfully theirs.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's
in fact, crazy. In most of our traditions, our old regalia, you know, like the clothes that we wear for dancing, or our old ceremonial works, these things are not meant to be on display.
Mm.
When someone dies, they're buried with their regalia in a lot of circumstances. So even the idea of putting these things behind glass for English people to look at is very offensive to a lot of us.
Mm. Yeah.
You know? Yeah. You stole it and, you know, we believe it has the right to be buried, you know, on our land.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was talking about this. I mean, I feel like I bring it up like once a week to someone that I've met because I'm shocked, but also not shocked at how little I knew back home. Because I was like, I'm baffled that we don't get taught this considering it was us. But then on the flip side, you're like, well, why would they educate you in something horrific that your country did?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like coming to Canada, I knew that Canada and the UK were connected, just that we colonized it, but to know like how deep that connection has gone and that it's not spoken about back in England. It's a very English thing, I think, to kind of just be like, it happened, we're sorry, and then just like brush it under the carpet, don't do anything else, like pretend it didn't happen type of thing. And I think that's one thing that I'm definitely going to be taking back with me is like, I spoke to my parents and I was like, this is insane. Like that we don't get taught this, because my dad was born in Toronto and he knew roughly like bits and pieces. But I was like, it's nuts, like how little we know back home. And none of my friends knew anything.
Yeah, I have cousins who are Squamish who live in Brighton, England.
Yeah.
And my auntie will walk around and people will be like, huh, you look very interesting. What's your like background?
Yeah.
What's your ethnicity? And she'll be like, oh, I'm Squamish First Nation. They're like, what is that?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm like Indigenous to Canada. What do you mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't even kind of register in their brain for a while to even think that that's like a kind of person that could be in England right now. Like, what?
Mm-hmm.
Why are you here?
Yeah.
What?
And I think
you guys still exist. You guys are still around. What?
I think there's that, and there's also the fact that people just genuinely don't know, never heard the word like Squamish.
Oh,
and they're just like,
not at all.
Huh? Yeah. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Coast Salish. What?
Yeah.
What is that?
Literally, honestly, it's crazy how sheltered I have found England to be leaving it, because you don't notice it when you're there and you've lived there and everything, but it's like coming out of it and I'm just like, we are so sheltered to the rest of the world, we are so unbelievably ignorant to stuff going on, and especially stuff that's not going into mainstream like news. And I think we will just take a break there to hear some music that Palandria has brought with her. This is music that you're performing to, is it?
Yeah. Yes. So this will be a solo in the show that I am presenting on October 12th.
Awesome. So I hope you guys enjoy listening.
I'm cut off. In this world I roam. No one to save me. I'm in this alone. Blink. I'm in solitude. I'm not sure that you can help me. Blink. I'm in solitude, and I'm not sure that you can help me. The river flows, but I can't stop it. 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 Blink.
Coco.
And I'm DJ Star.
Come join us for Slumber Party, Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
You'll hear female artists, oversharing, and research on health, psychology, and identity.
Hope to see you there.
Welcome back to Intravenous on CJSF 90.1 FM, campus and community radio at Simon Fraser University, and we just heard a piece of music that will be part of Palandria's performance in the upcoming residency dance event, Recentering Margins.
Yeah.
And we've just been talking a bit about the meaning behind dance to Palandria as an Indigenous woman, and I did want to ask you if whether you have, I don't know whether your experience just with dance throughout your life, you've seen this or recently, but have you seen the dance community become more inclusive over the years? Or
yeah, I think I'm starting to see it. at SFU myself, I've witnessed, I did the BFA in dance on the SFU Vancouver campus. So I've witnessed, even just in the 4 years that I was doing that program, a lot of changes happening. People making effort to hire professors who are BIPOC and who bring different dance experiences to their work, you know? Mm-hmm. Like maybe they're trained in traditional Chinese dance or trained in traditional Jamaican dance, Ugandan dance.
Yeah.
So we got to kind of experience more kinds of dance than just American modern dance or ballet, you know?
Yeah.
And that's really helpful. But I think there's a lot of work to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think primarily the issue is that if you're Indigenous or you're Black or you're a person of color, you can get in the room. But the issue really is poverty. There's mm-hmm. no place for people who are poor. And there's no place for people who have other responsibilities. That's kind of what I've witnessed. A lot of Indigenous folk have responsibilities at home. They have to care for their grandparents. They maybe have children of their own that they have to take care of. Maybe they, you know, have to work multiple jobs to support their brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm.
And those things are not taken as something that can be a priority. It's not really respected, and it's seen as kind of, you know, oh, you're just not taking this seriously. You're not willing to prioritize dance. You're not ready to be a dancer if you're not willing to put in the work. You need to be here on time every single day. It's like my kid was throwing up, okay?
Yeah.
I had to prioritize being a parent first. Those things are not respected. And until we start kind of bridging that cultural and socioeconomic gap, I don't think we're going to see true equality.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that's a reason that's seen so much for women mm-hmm. just in the workplace, whatever sector it is, that it's like your role as a mother or your role as like a caregiver
mm-hmm.
cannot be put above your job.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very capitalist kind of framework that I see, because it's like the people that you love and the people that you care about should be your priority. That should Absolutely. Come above everything else, like above money, above work, above it all. Ultimately, mm-hmm. giving back, I think, to like your parents in whatever way you can, because they gave up so much to raise you. It's that's like, for me, the least you could do
mm-hmm.
type of thing. But yeah, no, definitely. So what advice would you give to emerging dancers, or particularly emerging choreographers that are from these disempowered communities?
The biggest piece of advice that I can give is literally just reach out and ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to do, but there are a lot of people who are willing to support you, but they just don't know you exist yet.
Yeah.
Right? So what got me my job at Vinnie Dancy is I literally just emailed the artistic director of the company, and I was like, hey, I want to learn more about traditional Métis dance. This is something I'm really serious about. Do you offer internships?
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, no, we've never done that, but we can try.
Yeah.
You know, let's look into it. I've mm-hmm. never tried it before, but we're open to trying. If you're willing to do free work for us or something, that's okay.
Yeah.
We'll look into it. And now I've been with the company for over 2 years and still going strong. So especially if you find other people from similar communities as you, if you reach out to them, people are very, very generous, I find. But you have to be willing to have the strength to, you know, put aside your ego and your pride and just be like, look, I am really drowning here, and I need work, and I need support, and I need someone to teach me. Are you willing to help me?
Definitely. I think that kind of mentality can be used in so many different parts of life
mm-hmm.
as well. There is this almost unspoken fear of asking for help. Uh-huh. It's almost like you've completely failed if you are asking for help. Like, it's completely like the end of the line. Uh-huh. I've seen it with like friends and family members that it seems such a scary thing to just be like, I can't do this on my own. Uh-huh. I need some help to be able to achieve what you want to achieve. But you get, I mean, we got taught when we were younger, like at school, it's like, you're not going to be born with every ounce of knowledge to succeed in life. You have to like make the mistakes. Mm-hmm. You have to ask for the help in order to reach where you want to reach.
Yeah, it's not always like something you can do on your own. Mm-hmm. A lot of like Canada Council grants, BC Arts grants, you need people to write recommendation letters for you. Mm. You need someone in the industry to vouch for you to even get your application in the room. Mm-hmm. So, like it or not, you will need help from people.
Yeah.
So you might as well be the first one to ask for it instead of waiting around for someone to notice you, to notice that you're struggling and do it for you, because that's not always going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. With your performance that is coming up, what are you hoping that the audience will take away? Like emotions or ideas? Is there something that you're really hoping speaks to the audience and they can take that away from your performance?
My whole kind of idea with adapting science fiction into movement is I really love the idea of the abstraction of explaining kind of what settler colonialism is like, the emotions of it, the true psychological horror of it. But kind of abstracting it in a way so that it doesn't feel so real and so immediately triggering in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I create work, I like to imagine my grandparents sitting in the audience. Oh, I'm getting emotional thinking about it. I lost my grandmother and my grandfather.
Mm.
The ones from my Indigenous side of the family. And they loved to dance.
Yeah.
They were competitive square dancers and Lindy Hoppers.
Oh, that's amazing.
And the Caribou. They raised my mom in Williams Lake, so kind of central interior BC.
Mm-hmm.
And they loved dance so much. But they felt so excluded from academic spaces. Contemporary dance can be very off-putting to working class people or to undereducated people, because we go so crazy into the abstract and so crazy beyond things that they're familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
So I always like to kind of explain my concepts in a way that's very easily enjoyable by the vast majority of people.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're, you know, a young viewer, if you're 5 years old, you should be able to walk into a contemporary dance show and be like, wow, that was pretty.
Yeah.
Wow, that was so fun. I loved the cute little dragons that were crawling around on the ground in that piece. You know, it doesn't always have to be some crazy over-the-top production to have a really lasting impact on people. Mm-hmm. So I hope that people take away joy from watching it, not just this, you know, deep, solemn, contemplative vibe, but I hope they just genuinely enjoy it.
Yeah.
And by creating a work that people enjoy, I hope that kind of gets these ideas in the door for people. You know, if they're already clapping along and smiling and having a good time, then it's a lot easier to kind of insert these ideas of, hey, so we still have a lot of work to do about decolonialization, you know? And a lot of people are still complicit in these ideas and these struggles. So we need your help, actually.
Yeah. And I think that sounds like the perfect way of describing your show and your performance. I'm just conscious of the time that we are about to cut off, but I encourage everybody to go check out the Palandra's performance as well as the other dancers at this event. I will leave the information in below, and time for Democracy Now.
Hi, I'm Amy.